This is going to be another kind of adventure. From the talk that I gave on Tuesday. In this case, I put these slides together, and every time I go through them, I see something new and different in each slide. So it's all going to depend on what I happen to see this time. I'm going to talk about the polar stratopause and tropopause evolution and some implications for assimilated analyses. Let's see. Which button do I push on this machine? Okay. Some of the motivation for this. The detailed knowledge of the... here it is. The... region supplement, both the stratopause and the tropopause is crucial to understanding climate change and ozone recovery, largely for different reasons, or at least the obvious overt reasons are rather different. So the real motivation for this is that both are regions that I'm interested in. Another reason, the assimilation systems have recently, well, not so very recently for GMAO, the GEOS analyses from NASA, but they are now providing analyses that go up into the mesosphere, and analyses, of course, that include some trace gases, particularly ozone. But up in the mesosphere, and even in the upper stratosphere, the analyses, of course, of which we've heard many times in the past couple of days, are unconstrained by data, or largely unconstrained by data. So we haven't had much data to validate them, so we don't have much of an idea of what their quality is up there. And actually for studies of both regions, both the upper stratosphere and the lower mesosphere, which you'll see as USLM through this talk, and the upper troposphere, lower stratosphere, which you'll see abbreviated as UTLS, both of them have been hampered by lack of data in different ways. Basically, we've had almost nothing in the stratopause region and above. No long-term global data sets, very sporadic measurements from things like LIDAR and rocket sondes and so forth. Although we've had a considerable amount of temperature data from ground-based systems, from radio sondes and so forth in the UTLS region, we really haven't had much in the way of global long-term measurements of trace gases, because most of the earlier satellite instruments that tend to give you those sort of global fields have not extended down as far as the upper troposphere, lower stratosphere. So we've been, until the last few years, lacking in measurements of both of those regions. But in the last few years, we have the NASA's OAR mission has launched, which has a microwave limb sounder, which gets temperature and a number of trace gases down into the UTLS and up through the mesosphere. The SABR, which we've seen data from in several previous talks, which also gets data up through the mesosphere and beyond, well beyond. And of course the ACE FTS instrument, which gets temperatures and trace gas data from the upper troposphere, lower stratosphere, through the mesosphere. So what I'm going to do is just show some highlights from several different studies that we've been working on using these satellite data and using them in combination with the products from the assimilation systems to try to improve our understanding of these regions and to help assess how the assimilation systems do in these regions. Most of the examples are from the 2005-2006 Arctic winter, which we've heard a bit about already, when there was a very long, strong, prolonged stratospheric sudden warming that started in early to mid-January and continued basically through most of February, and some comparisons with other recent winters. Okay, data sets that we're going to be using here. The microwave wind sounder on the NASA's EOS Aura satellite provides near global daily fields of temperatures. It's 82 north to 82 south. And they provide them from the UTLS from about 300 millibars up through the mesosphere through about somewhere between 80 and 90 kilometers. I'm showing in various plots either version 1.5 or version 2.2 because we're still in the middle of reprocessing version 2.2. We don't have a complete mission, so for long time series I'll be showing version 1.5 data. SABR provides temperature data in the regions we're interested in, at least in the upper stratosphere, lower mesosphere, from about 50 degrees in one hemisphere to 85 in the other, switching hemispheres every 2 months, as a couple talks showed yesterday in some detail. And we're using the version 1.06 data. They are, again, reprocessing in version 1.07, but we don't have those data yet. I'm going to show just a little bit here and there of ACE-FTS data. It provides up to about 30 profiles per day at two latitudes, and again from the upper troposphere, lower stratosphere. The temperatures actually only go down to 12 kilometers, below which they are constrained by CMC temperatures, so temperatures from an analysis system. That's version 2.2 data. And I will show just a little bit of some ground-based data. I'll probably show the LIDAR data. Probably won't get to the radiosonde data that we use to compare with some of these data and with the assimilation systems. For trace gas data, MLS gets things that are useful in the UTLS, probably ozone, water, and carbon monoxide. And in the version 2.2, the nitric acid has been improved in those lower levels, so it's also a useful product in the UTLS region. ACE measures, again, the same sort of things that should be useful in the UTLS region, and also their HCL should be useful for studying the UTLS. Both of them measure carbon monoxide and water, which are useful tracers in the upper stratosphere and lower mesosphere. And I'm not going to show any of it here. If I could show only just a little bit of ACE data at all, but ACE, the Maestro instrument on ACE, also measures ozone that gets useful values in the upper troposphere, lower stratosphere. Okay, assimilation products. We've heard a lot about a lot of these already. GEOS-4 and GEOS-5, model top is about 0.01 millibars, about 80 kilometers. They have a non-orographic gravity wave scheme. It's a fairly simple one. The GEOS-4 is at 1 by 1.25 degree resolution, horizontal resolution. The GEOS-5 is about double that, but they output the fields on a slightly coarser grid. Both of these, the GEOS-4 has 55 model levels from the surface to 0.01. The GEOS-5 has 72 model levels. The ECMWF analyses, during the periods we're studying here, they changed from the T511 60 level system with a top at 0.1 millibars to the T789 91 level system with a top at 0.01 millibars. That operational change was on 1 February. We actually have some of these data that are shown here from a couple of months before that. They don't have a non-orographic gravity wave stream, but just use a Rayleigh friction to slow the upper stratospheric jet. The output is used at various resolutions here, and I'll try to point out what resolution I'm using in the different plots. It's just different time periods and altitude regions where we have different products from the ECMWF. And for some of the UTLS stuff, I will also show some of the Met Office analyses, which have a top near 0.1 millibars, coarse resolution until March 2006, when they go to a very fine resolution, when they went to using the same model for these stratospheric assimilations that they to provide us those products they use for the NWP systems. I'll show some preliminary results from a couple research assimilation systems. The CMAM data assimilation system, which you've heard quite a bit about already, and we'll hear some more details from Shushen Ren in a talk later this morning. It's got a very high model top. I think it's from 0.0008 millibars or something like that. It's got a comprehensive online transport and chemistry stream, but no actual chemical assimilation. But because the scheme is online, the ozone and so forth are interactive with the radiation scheme. A fairly coarse horizontal resolution works out to about 3 3/4 degrees, and a fairly comprehensive non-orographic gravity wave scheme. I'm going to show some NOGAPS alpha simulations, of which Carl Hoppel will give a lot more detail in a talk again later this morning. The model top is just a little above 0.01, near 0.005 millibars. This experiment is assimilating MLS and Sabre temperatures up to 0.01 millibars, and ozone, I think that's up to a bit lower level, but I don't remember the exact number. It's about, again, it's a spectral model, but it's about 1.5 by 1.5 degrees resolution. And this particular experiment, they have several gravity wave schemes they can use. This particular experiment just uses a Rayleigh friction. The NOGAPS one is the only one that assimilates MLSA. So there's several operational systems, and the two research systems, basically the things I highlight in them, one of them assimilates MLS and Sabre. The other one has a very high top and a fairly sophisticated non-orographic gravity wave scheme. So there are two different things that may improve some of the products. We hope improve some of the products. Okay, so just a little background. We're going to start off with the stratopause and work down. So what does the stratopause do? What is the structure of it? We haven't actually had a lot of data to really look at this. But here's an example of what we have now. These are 70 degrees latitude MLS temperatures, zonal means, as a function of pressure to 0.001 millibars, down to 300 millibars here. And so the warm point here is basically what we define as the stratopause. It also corresponds to, although I didn't put the contour on this particular version of the spot, it corresponds to a static stability of 4 × 10⁻⁴ one over a second squared. Keep that number in mind for later. So and these are showing November through May, so the whole fall, winter, spring season. Northern hemisphere on the left, southern hemisphere on the right, in two different years in each case. So in 2004-2005, this was a cold northern winter, so a fairly typical winter without any strong major warmings and so forth. And the stratopause starts off at about maybe 55 kilometers or so, 50 to 55 kilometers, and it drops a little bit through the course of the winter and then a little bit more during spring. So it's really sort of a downward progression all the way from fall, from sort of late fall, early winter, through the spring season when it gets down to maybe a little bit below 50 kilometers. You see this kind of increase or decrease in the mesosphere, increase in the stratosphere in temperatures along a kind of a sloped time date. That's actually the final warming in that year, which is a very early final warming, is what they call a major final warming. There's fairly similar behavior in the southern hemisphere, but the stratopause itself is over the whole winter and spring season is a little bit warmer than in the northern hemisphere. Significant interannual variability, but the same general behavior in terms of the altitude regions and so forth. In terms of the cold point, which is typically in the lower stratosphere, again, you see a fairly similar qualitative evolution in the two hemispheres. Of course, it's much colder at those levels in the southern hemisphere, and considerable interannual variability in the timing and so forth of the evolution of that cold point. Note that the cold point here is actually not anywhere near the tropopause. The tropopause is way down, defined by dynamical or temperature gradient definitions, which are usually used as way down in the sort of 300 to 400 millibar range, and we'll look at that a little bit later. The northern hemisphere 2005-2006 winter, of course, is very, very different. This is, we start out very similar to the previous winter, but starting in, even back in December at the highest levels, the mesospheric temperatures start cooling, the stratopause starts dropping, and the stratosphere warming, and we go into a strong major warming. This actually became a major warming about the middle of January, so right about here, just after the middle of January. So during that time, the stratopause dropped dramatically. I mean, it gets down to, if you can define it towards the end of January here, it gets down maybe even to about 10 millibars or 30 kilometers, very, very low. But it actually is, and as you see even more so later, very ill-defined at this time. And then it reforms very, very high, up about 75, maybe even above 75 kilometers, 0.01 millibars, and then very gradually drops to a similar value in the spring as the other winters. So how do the analyses do in trying to get this? Now, this is very difficult. This is now just cutting off the same kind of plot, but just cutting off showing January, February, March, and April. So here's the MLS data that we just saw. I've just put a kind of cyan line here about at the level where the stratosphere pause reforms. That's at 0.03 millibars is that line. And comparing with the SABRE data, it's the SABRE and MLS data show very good agreement in terms of the overall evolution. A few differences in the specific magnitudes of the temperatures, and a lot of those may be related to partially, there may be some biases between the two instruments, but also related to the different vertical resolutions. The vertical resolution of MLS in the stratopause region is only maybe about 7 kilometers, and it's about 2 kilometers for SABRE. Now, an analysis with a top at 0.01 millibar isn't going to capture a stratopause at about 0.01 millibar. So what did it do with it? Well, the GEOS 5 kind of shifts it down and makes it much too warm. The ECMWF kind of shifts it down and makes it rather too cool. And they So they both not only have difficulty with that structure, but the GS5 in particular also has difficulty with the cold point structure below that. You see, this looks a little more sensible in the ECMWF compared to MLS and Sabre, but we've got a bit of an oddity in the GS5 during this whole recovery period, so it isn't doing very well. Now, if we look at the research systems, the CMAM, with a very high top, but not assimilating anything other than the standard sort of meteorological products that all of these systems assimilate, does quite a bit better. It doesn't get the stratopause quite high enough, but it does much better with the whole overall structure of the temperatures during that recovery period, and does much better with the temperatures of the evolution of the temperatures of the stratopause. The NOGAPS model, which has some of the same failings as the operational ones in terms of not very sophisticated gravity wave schemes, not really quite high enough a model top, et cetera, but it's assimilating these temperatures. And it does much better at getting the location, even though it's very near the model top, and the evolution of the stratopause in the time period to which we have the model run out. Another view of the same thing. This is as a function of latitude and time for the same period, the stratopause altitude and the stratopause temperature. So we were looking at a section across like this before. Just to very quickly recap, it shows the same effects as the MLS and the Sabre, which show quite good agreement, extremely high stratopause, well above 70 kilometers in the reformation phase. And the GS5 and the ECMWF make it much too low. The GS5 is much too warm during the recovery period at high latitudes, and the ECMWF is rather too cold for a long period at the higher latitudes. And in both circumstances, both the CMAM and the NOGAPS are giving you, for different reasons, significant improvements. So essentially we have an improvement due to better characteristics of the model and an improvement due to assimilating the MLS and Sabre data. So, you know, two different ways that you can try to improve the model. Just a note on what we're actually seeing here, just a couple things to note about that we're learning about the stratopause is you note that there's very, no matter whether the stratopause is high or low, it is always very strong gradients in the altitude and particularly in the temperature between the mid-latitudes and the high latitudes. So even during these very disturbed events, we have in some sense a separated stratopause in the mid-latitudes and high latitudes, although in this event it's doing this. Okay, and what is quickly the synoptic structure of that look like? This is MLS Sabre and three analyses, GS5 and the two research products. 16th of January, just going into the warming where the stratopause is dropping. 30th of January, which is in that time when it's ill-defined, and the 25th of February. These are longitude snapshots around the 70-degree north latitude circle. So the stratopause is actually separated in longitude as well as latitude, and you have this kind of secondary temperature maximum that MLS and Sabre capture, and of course the operational analyses can't do that. The CMAM is actually getting that sort of structure, although the magnitudes of the temperatures are a little different, and no gaps in assimilating MLS and Sabre data is capturing sort of the lower part of the structure that's within its model domain. All the analyses at this point are capturing the statopause structure pretty well. But as we go into this period where it's ill-defined, and you look at these sort of small patterns of differences in the temperatures, it's really nearly isothermal. Again, the GS5 just has real trouble getting those even down, well down into the stratosphere, whereas both the CMAM and the NOGAPS are doing a good job on the stratospheric part of that structure, and the CMAM is actually doing quite a good job on the mesospheric part of that structure, that secondary temperature maximum. During the recovery phase, this is kind of interesting, this is after the stratopause has dropped quite a bit, but there's still large altitude variations around a longitude circle. And the GS5 gets the right sort of structure, but it's just sort of squashed by the Molotov being too low. And the NOGAPS that assimilates the MLS data does this very nicely. But the CMAM actually doesn't do that great, and it actually doesn't make this low part quite low enough. It's sort of an interesting result, and not anything we've had time to explore in any detail. Okay, I'm running way too slow here, but we'll just carry on. This is MLS temperatures as a function of equivalent latitude and potential temperature. And what I'm just trying to show here is the relationship between the jet structure, which the overlay's contours are wind speed. From the wind speeds and the PV used for the mapping are from GS4, so we only go up as high as it goes. But basically, so we have a jet, a sort of double jet here before the warming. And basically, the separation in the stratopause is across that jet. And even when the jet is breaking down, the separation is still across the axis of the jet. And as it's reforming, again, it's still across the axis. So the separation of the stratopause between polar and high latitudes is always kind of across the axis of that jet. If we look at the, now this is really complicated, but this is a 2000K, 2500K, and 3200K. And if you see this solid white line, that's a 4 times 10 to the minus 4th static stability contour, and that marks the level of the temperature maximum, basically. Shows you where the stratopause is. And the little dotted line is to the mesospheric side of that. So in this case, and this is on the 15th of January, so when we're going into that very disturbed period, in this case, the lower latitudes are in the mesosphere and the higher latitudes are in the stratosphere. This is after the stratosphere has dropped to fairly low altitudes. The colors are potential vorticity contours, and there are a few wind vectors overlaid, which just show you that the jets really follow what those potential vorticity contours are doing. So this is what this is actually what the vortex is in the very upper part of the stratosphere on the 15th of January, that it's mostly broken down already. And as you go up, you can see that, and it's really, at this time, there's really not much of a simple circumpolar vortex at the higher levels. The 15th of February, 14th of February is after the vortex has reformed strongly, as Lynn showed us yesterday, in the upper stratosphere. And we see something like a fairly circumpolar vortex going all the way up to 3200K, which is in the mesosphere. Most of these this is mostly in the stratosphere, but these two levels are mostly in the mesosphere on this date. It's a fairly circumpolar jet, but it's a little more complex structure than we see down at the lower levels. And again, by the 15th of March, they're starting to the vortex is starting to decay a little bit again, become a little more distorted in the upper stratosphere. And again, we're seeing quite a bit more complex structure up here in the as we get into the lower mesosphere. In a sense, this is the question yesterday of, you know, where is the top of the vortex? Well, the character of the vortex really changes quite a bit as you go up. So I'm not sure where is the top of the vortex is quite the right question. This is just comparing, these are PVMFs again, this is just comparing at 3200K and 2000K, the upper and lower of those levels, on the 15th of January, so that very disturbed date, comparing the PV fields between the different analyses that we've looked at. So we see, well, at 2000K we see really very good broad qualitative agreement between the major features, with a lot of the differences depending in terms of the detailed structure, depending in a way that we kind of tend to expect on the resolution of the models. But you can see some differences. I mean, the CMAM looks very noisy, and that's probably because of the rich spectrum of gravity waves that it has that none of the others with simpler gravity wave schemes include. But the question is, you know, you see similarities and differences in these fields. And the question is, you know, how can we get some kind of assessment of how good they are? Well, and this is where the MLS data comes in and the other recent trace gas data we have. This is showing vertical sections of vortex averages. I'm just averaging within a PV contour, and in this particular case it's from GEOS-4, but it doesn't make much difference what analysis I use. From the stratopause down, and this is showing the sort of the standard descent into the vortex. This is carbon monoxide here, water, and methane from ACE. All of these are showing the sort of standard descent of air from the mesosphere into the stratospheric vortex. At this point, we have the major warming. That signature is destroyed. And we have then the vortex reforms very strongly, and we have basically a replay of that fall signature, where we again see the descent of mesospheric air into the stratospheric vortex. So we now have these measurements, and comparing these with both with simulated winds and PV fields, and also with models driven with those winds, which is what I'm showing here. These are the MLS data on the left here. On the right is a SWIMCAT simulation, which is driven with ECMWF winds, of the same field. And so you can see there are some differences, particularly in this recovery period in the descent from the mesosphere, which may be due to it may or may not be due to the winds that are driving it. That's one possible factor. Other possible factors are top boundary effects in the model, problems in the model chemistry, if there is some chemistry as well as the transport driving these patterns here. But they give us a tool, and this is just another simple way of looking at the same sort of thing Lynn was getting at yesterday, which is, you know, how well do these trace gas fields agree with the winds? And in this case, I'm showing PV contours, which, you know, shows you basically what the winds are doing, what the jet structures are doing. So again, it's 2,500 and 3,200K. On the same 3 days, I showed the PV4, and this is MLS carbon monoxide. You can do the same thing with water, see the same sort of correlations. But at 2000K, we see very, very nice agreement between the high CO and the shapes of the PV contours. This is a bit of, CO is a bit of a noisy field for MLS, so we do see some noise in these fields. Still seeing very nice agreement as we go up even on this disturbed day with the sort of small, some of these sort of small features like this. And again, it's a little bit more complicated at 3200K, but if you look at the correspondence of the PV contours and the MLS data, we're still seeing quite nice agreement, including some of these sort of tongues here that come out. There's some regions like this and this where they seem maybe a little displaced, and maybe that's where we're starting to see the analyses not quite capturing the details of the structures. So I'm going to skip that because I want to, and I'm going to skip that too. Well, I'm not going to skip that, although it was just very fast. One thing we've done besides comparing with the MLS data is compare the MLS SABR and some of the analyses with some LIDAR data. And this is just another tool to give us a handle on the analyses. These top two panels are in February and March 2004. The bottom two are in 2005 on the left and 2006, both February on the right. And if as you'll see in a moment, both 2004 and 2006 had these very strong prolonged major warmings, and 2005 didn't. And just the one thing I want to point out here while we're on the analysis data thing is that if you see this little purple line, that's GEOS 4. There's purple and green lines for GEOS 5 in the next couple of years, and a couple pale green line for ECMWF in 2006, which is the new L91 system that goes up. And the bottom line is that the analyses do very poorly in the disturbed winters and very much better in the sort of undisturbed winter, which probably isn't a big surprise. But let's move down and talk about the tropopause for just a few minutes. I obviously always have too much material. This is the 3 years, three most recent years, and I'm just showing analyses here now for the tropopause, because we're talking about the tropopause at very high latitudes. This is at Eureka, which is at 80 degrees north, 86 degrees west, and the reason I'm showing it at Eureka is because there were a bunch of ACE validation campaigns there. And so I've done a lot of work to try to characterize what the meteorology is doing during those campaigns. That's what the yellow lines on this plot here mark the beginning of those campaigns. And so I'm showing a whole set of different analyses, and you're going to say, there's too many lines on there, you can't tell them apart. Well, I say, it doesn't matter if you can't tell them apart, because what matters is the times when you can tell them apart. So if there are any. And so if we just look at 2005, 2006, we actually see all of the analyses are doing quite well at capturing the same behavior for the tropopause. And a lot of the differences in the extremes are probably going to be related to the different resolutions of the data set. The ECMWF, for example, where you tend to see some higher extremes, is one of the highest resolution data sets. In this particular case, I'm using it sampled at 0.5 by 0.5 degree. So this is a pretty high resolution. So all the systems are doing pretty well here. This isn't a surprise, because they're all tied to radiosonde data. And they all assimilate pretty much the same sort of products in this region. But let's look for a moment at the vortex structure, or the structure of what we call the sub-vortex region, or the region where we may have the bottom of the polar vortex and also be in the lowermost stratosphere. That is, we're crossing the tropopause. It's a little hard to see on this screen, but there's a white contour right here, which is a 4.5 PV unit contour. You know, that's near one of the higher values that people usually use to define the tropopause. But actually, if you look at the PV gradients, it's right outside on this particular plot. It's right outside the sort of green-yellow. Actually, the strongest PV gradients in this region, which probably demarks where the transport barrier is maybe at even a little bit higher values in some of these. Again, this is showing six different analyses. I'm showing the Met Office now that we're low enough where they get good fields. And again, we see really, really fairly large-scale biases. It's not a simple pattern. For instance, we can have GS4 with a very high bias in the PV in the southern hemisphere. This is southern hemisphere, sort of early summer, winter in the northern hemisphere, but not particularly high in the northern hemisphere winter. So it's a very, very complex pattern of large-scale biases, and very nice agreement in all of these at very different resolutions. And I didn't get the right plot in here. I corrected that. It's really more like 1.5 degrees. In the small-scale features, and particularly right here we have, which is associated with the forcing for this big stratospheric warming that's starting then, we have a nice event of nice sort of quasi-atmospheric stratotope exchange event that's represented very clearly in all of these analyses. Even the quite low resolution CMAM analyses has a very clear representation of that. Some smaller events like this little tongue that goes in here, you could see those essentially in all the analyses. And a number of other examples, the little tongue of stratospheric air that's kind of extending out into the troposphere and so forth. So you can stare at that for hours and see all kinds of interesting features. But you know, again, you know, how can we really validate that? And now I'm actually turning to ozone. So again, we're going back to using the satellite data to look at the structures in that region. And I'm showing ozone from MLS on the top left and a couple of transport models. This is just a 12-day reverse trajectory calculation. So what I'm doing here is actually taking, it's initialized with MLS data. I'm just using this and transporting it for 12 days with a GEOS-5 wind. And basically what that is doing for me is just getting me a very high resolution version of what MLS would be expected to see. So it's a very short, very simple transport calculation. And so this gives you kind of a high resolution version of what we expect from the MLS measurements a few days beforehand. This is the GeoSchem model, which is a full comprehensive tropospheric chemistry offline chemical transport model. In this particular case, it's driven with GEOS-4 winds. So that's comprehensive chemistry offline transport. Then we have a GEOS-4, which is this is an offline CTM model. This is a stratospheric model or a stratospheric tropospheric model. The GEOS-10 doesn't have much in the way of a stratosphere. So this is offline transport. The GEOS-5 has online ozone transport with parameterized chemistry and so forth. ECMWF, of course, is a parameterized chemistry online transport and ozone assimilation. GS5 assimilates SBUV, ECMWF, I never can quite remember exactly what, but I think it's mostly SBUV and TOMS. And then the CMAM, which has comprehensive online chemistry and transport, but doesn't assimilate ozone. And the NOGAPS, which is assimilating MLS data. And again, we see really substantial differences. the GEOSCAM and the CMAP and the ECMWF, but we won't go there, show considerably higher ozone values in the southern hemisphere, and it looks very much like looking at the lower levels and look at the evolution. This is actually because both of them don't, neither of them gets a strong enough ozone hole. And this is in January in the southern hemisphere. This is after the ozone depletion has stopped, but the low values from the low values that you had from the ozone hole were still hanging around. So this is sort of the lingering effects of not getting that heterogeneous chemistry right. As Chris pointed out yesterday in his talk, in terms of the small scale structures, basically those are all driven by the dynamics, by the winds. And it's obvious that they're all doing pretty well because they all really capture very nicely the same sort of patterns of stratigraphic change and so forth. I have a couple more slides which are just showing the time evolution of the tropopause, comparing the analyses and comparing with the assimilated GS5 and MLSO. So I'm going to skip over those because I'm just about out of time. I'll allow time for maybe one or two questions. I've basically tried to, I'm not going to read you the examples of the kind of fields I've shown, but my whole point here is that we've got a lot of new satellite data, both for trace gases and temperatures, and those give us a lot of improved tools for assessing this and improving the assimilation systems in a number of different ways, both the models and the products that are assimilated. And there are a couple of submitted papers that are available on the web in various forms that show a lot of this material, particularly on the temperatures. Thank you.